Return, O virgin daughter of Israel, to these your highways by which you went. Welcome to Reunion Roadmap, a place to discover the people and communities along the highway of restoration for Israel's house of Joseph. Reunion Roadmap is a B'nai Yosef North America production. Be our guest for the next hour as we meet the people of the emerging house of Joseph here in North America. Shalom. This is Stefani Pappas with B'nai Yosef North America. And with me is Al McCarn, our executive director. And we're going to Australia to interview somebody who's been involved with writing books, actually, about the 10 tribes.
Well, yes, Suzanne Ratcliffe. Suzanne is writing a series of historical fiction novels in which the Lost Tribes of Israel feature prominently. Now, specifically, it's the Lost Tribes as they migrated to Denmark and Western Europe and Britain. But this does have a global flavor, especially when you get into the second book. The first book is called Stones of Wrath, The Tapestry. It's a great read. I'll tell you, I've been a connoisseur of fiction all my life, and what Suzanne has written is top-notch historical fiction. She's done her homework on so many historical things. She has woven her family's history into the storyline, and I'm excited about it. It takes what we know of where did the 10 tribes of Israel go, and takes it into the realm of fiction where it's a safe topic. You know, in fiction, we can explore things like, space travel, alien technology, any kind of subject that might be considered extreme, fringe, taboo, you know, questionable in serious discussion. Well, Suzanne is taking the 10 tribes of Israel, which are by no means theoretical, fringe, whatever. It's just people aren't aware that the tribes were scattered to every nation. They're still there, and they are coming back because God said so. So with that as introduction, let's go on to Maitland, Australia, and meet Suzanne Ratcliffe. Welcome back to another interview with Reunion Roadmap. Today, we get to travel to Maitland, New South Wales, Australia, and meet author Suzanne Ratcliffe, the author of Stones of Wrath, The Tapestry, which is the first in a series. Suzanne, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, now, as we are recording, Stones of Wrath, The Tapestry is about to be published. Tell us a little bit what the book's about.
Okay, so I will read from the blurb on the back of the book because it took me a while to get the exact right words, so I'm going to read it from there. A royal tapestry, a kidnapped child, a 3,000-year-old biblical relic. These were not what archaeology professor Michael Jacobson was expecting when he surveyed the ruins of Sheffield Manor in the spring of 1916. As head of the new humanities faculty at the university, he had been called on to verify an exciting find, a tapestry, rumoured to have belonged to the imprisoned Mary Queen of Scots. Woven into the stitching is a coded message sent from her grandmother, Antoinette de Bourbon. It hints at the whereabouts of a biblical relic that should have changed the course of Mary's history. The relic has an appointment with the future and in the wrong hands will bring death and destruction. We follow the professor and his friends as they join in the dangerous race to find and protect the relic from malevolent forces. I'll just carry on. Stones of Wrath, The Tapestry is a novel filled with suspense, mystery, romance, and history. The International Historical Adventure is the first in the Breakthrough series by author S.J. Ratcliffe. That's me. I have won the 5-star highly recommended award of excellence from the Historical Fiction Company in the USA. And I have a website where you can read my blogs and so on.
Okay, so tell us your website.
Okay, so it's S.J. Ratcliffe, author.com. Now, the Ratcliffe is spelled with a T, R-A-T-C-L-I-F-F-E, sjratcliffeauthor.com.
And I like your website because it's got your blog, it's filled with pictures and stories of your travels, all of which contributed to this series that you're writing. So go to sjratcliffeauthor.com. You can find out more about Suzanne and about her books. Now, Suzanne, in the blurb that you just read, you mention a lot of exciting things. 1916, that tells me this is World War One.
Correct. It is World War One, but it starts in 793 AD in Lindisfarne when the Vikings raid the Holy Island of Lindisfarne. And I can say a few things about that. There's a passenger on the Viking ship who's a Christian who's listened to St. Aidan and has a secret ark that he carries. No, it's not the Ark of the Covenant. Don't worry. This is not a rewrite of Raiders of the Lost Ark. But it's a secret ark that has something special for the future. And he asks the monk Aidan, Ordlak, who's there, to hide it in the mountain. So there's a big castle there, and it's not a mountain, it's a great big hill. And he asks the monk to hide it there. And this is the story of how the ark gets hidden on the holy island of Lindisfarne until the future. And the future starts at World War One in Sheffield. Underneath Sheffield is Mary Queen of Scots tunnels, which are real, they exist. And I didn't know they were there until I found a tin that belonged to my auntie. And her grandmother, our great-grandmother, had written an article in the newspaper about these tunnels of Mary Queen of Scots. And so, of course, I had to use the tunnels. Mary Queen of Scots became forefront of my mind after I found this tin, this letter, this newspaper article. It's on my website, by the way, the newspaper article. And, yeah, so it's fascinating to think that Mary Queen of Scots did build all these tunnels and why she built them under Sheffield, who knows. But she also did do tapestries. She made tapestries, her and her grandmother, and from the French court. But in my book, one of the tapestries has a secret code to a secret biblical artifact.
So that's part of the fascination of your novel is... This is the mark of good historical fiction. You take real life persons, real events and situations and places, and you weave the narrative or weave them into your narrative.
So, yes, it's actually quite fun to do that. I enjoy that. And I enjoy the fact that I can make things up and it seems very realistic with the added thing that there's some of it's true. You know, quite a lot of the things in my books are actually really true. They really happened. Like, for example, the bombing of Sheffield by a Zeppelin. Who knew? A Zeppelin did bomb Sheffield in World War One, and one of my characters, Thomas, is based on my great-grandfather. He's a Wesleyan Methodist minister, and his church is in my book and in real life, became the church that got bombed by the Zeppelin. And right on the back wall was the Ten Commandments that was still standing. The Ten Commandments were still standing and visible after the Zeppelin bombed it. And that blew me away because the Ten Commandments feature in my book and they're important. And when I read that actually happen, it was like a sign from God, you know, that I was on the right track to know that these Ten Commandments hung there on that wall as a declaration to all that's wrong with war and, you know, the things that could be cured if only we followed the Lord.
True. Absolutely true. Now, I had great fun in reading the novel of doing some research or just pulling the threads of things that you mentioned, like the Zeppelin raid on Sheffield. I looked and sure enough, it did happen. Another place. Your character Mikkel Jacobsen takes us to Denmark to look at the menhirs or the dolmens, the standing stones there on one of the islands in Denmark. And I looked it up, and sure enough, they're there.
And my husband and I went to see them. Well, when I first decided about the book. I probably should just tell you the background. Way back, I went to Israel with my friend, and I noticed that all these little red-headed children, little Jewish children, so pretty with their little fetlocks. I think that's what they're called. And I went up to this Jewish man, and I said to him, he had these lovely little twins, and they were red-headed twins. And I said to him, do you think that your twins are related to King David? And he said, oh, yes, but certainly. And I started thinking, oh, I wonder if there's any link between, I know it's a bit random. People look at me and think I'm gone completely bonkers. But I thought, I wonder if there's any link between the Vikings and the Lost Tribes. And when I first started that journey, there was nothing. It was like I looked on the internet. I couldn't find anything at all. And then I just, Lord wouldn't let me let it go. You know, he really wouldn't let me go and let it go. And then I finally found Michael S. Cragg, and he had a free paper on there about the Israelitish connections and origins and to the Nordics. And so I looked, and sure enough, there is a connection between the Lost Tribes of Dan and the Vikings. Not that the Vikings were Lost Tribes in the sense that they knew they were, but my husband has red hair too. So that was kind of the reason. He's a Brit and he has red hair, and I really wanted to, I don't know, it was just a strange thing that I had this link in my mind that turned out to be true. And since then I found this unbelievable worldwide connection with all these doctor this and doctor that, you know, who all think there is this link, and just blew me away. And I'm now in contact with, Michael S. Cragg. We talk a lot, actually. He's quite excited because I named my main character after him, because I'm a big fan of his. He does YouTube videos, and his work is really easy to read. He's written his papers in such a way that are easy to read and good for the common man. And my books want to extend that to novels, because we want to get the word out that the Lost Tribes are a very interesting topic, and I believe, not everybody, but I believe in the last days, the tribes that will come back together, and it won't just be Judah and Benjamin. It will be all of the tribes, and God's going to do a great miracle, and it will be so exciting. It will be so exciting. Somehow God's going to let these people know, and some of these people already do know who they are, but the church needs to know this, and that's why I wanted to write my novels in a lovely, soft way to teach them about how important the Lost Tribes of Israel are. And that's nothing to do with replacement theology. I 100% support the Jewish people in Israel today, 100% love them unconditionally, will always support them. This is the other 10 tribes in their part in the future.
Well, we have several different directions we can go here. I want to put a peg on the replacement theology question and go back to the book itself. Here's my attempt at describing the book.
Okay.
You have a Christian romance novel. You have historical fiction adventure mystery. You have a spy novel. And you have an action military novel. All of that combined, and running through the whole thing is this thread of the Lost Tribes of Israel.
Yeah.
Specifically, we're talking Tribe of Dan, because you do have that Danish connection with your main character, Mikkel Jacobson. So thank you for explaining how you got inspired to write this. Do you know of any other work of fiction in which the Lost Tribes are a main feature?
No, and my book has been read and reviewed by Professor Dr. W.A. Liebenberg, and he said that no one has written a novel about the subject. And so when he read my novel, he was absolutely thrilled with it, and he's written a really wonderful review. So that's, I've got that on the front cover, that he's, or, you know, said how great my book is. Yes, and no one has written on this subject, so it's unique. And it's a thing that I believe God is doing. It's a new thing. And God is raising up these people all over the world to talk about it. But the there's this big full stop thingy that people are scared that it's replacement theology, but I promise you it is not. Promise you that.
Okay, so let's go there now. And I agree with you. This rebirth of the 10 tribes, this research into where Israel's lost tribes went, you know, there have been elements, some among British Israelites, some among Black Hebrews, others who would say, yes, we are the true Israelites and the Jews are not.
Yes, that's impossible. Yeah, that's absolutely impossible for it to be true. And besides, the knowledge is coming out more and more and more. The research, you know, it's phenomenal. You know, the YouTube videos, you know, Nicholas Craig does wonderful YouTube videos, and Professor W.A. Liebenberg does great papers. Of course he does. He's an academic of renown. So the knowledge is growing every day on the truth of this matter, and we need to embrace it and not be embarrassed about it, not be ashamed of it, and make sure people know that we're not replacing the Jews. We love them. You know, we truly love them.
Well, the way I have come to look at it is we have two halves of God's covenant family, the Jewish people and all of us from the nations who are largely Christian.
Yes.
And when Paul writes in Romans 11 about the we who were Gentiles, we're grafted into the olive tree of Israel. Well, if the Jewish people were not still in existence as the people of Israel, as the visible remnant of God's covenant nation, we wouldn't have anything to be grafted into.
Absolutely. That's so true.
Yes. So I praise God for that. I also look at, he's got two witnesses, just like he says in the Torah that a matter must be confirmed by two or three witnesses. Well, we have the Jewish people descended from the house of Judah, the kingdom of Judah. And then we have all the rest of us. If we're not Jewish, we must be from that other house, the house of Israel, the 10 tribes who were lost and scattered into the nations and who are now coming back with friends.
Yes, exactly that. And, you know, I think it's an exciting miracle that is going to happen, and the church is asleep about it. There's going to be a very exciting miracle going to happen in the end of days, you know, in the lead up to that. And we are all, we don't know. They need to know, and that's why I wrote my novels, because they need to know. And it's done in such a way that's nice and happy and positive, and, you know, it's got drama, and, you know, we do have some spies and things and that sort of thing going on. But it's a great way to teach the church, and that it's the church that I've gone written the books for. It's for the church. And originally I'm a teacher, so I wanted to connect with the youth. But when I looked online and I saw what the youth are reading, they're all reading fantasy. So I thought, no, I'm going to go to their mums and their grandmothers first. And so my books were written with women in mind, so that they could then take hold of the information and filter it down to these young ones. And, you know, it's lots of men have read my book, including you, and I'm quite surprised at how positive they've been. Because, like originally I said, it's written for women, but the men have enjoyed it too, and I'm really pleased with that.
Well, the tapestry, Stones of Wrath, the tapestry, that's the first in a series. We'll talk about it in the series in a minute, but some things that appealed to me, it's believable. I mean, the interactions with your characters are believable on a number of levels. The action that takes place in England and Denmark in 1916, it fits the era.
Yeah.
You've done your homework. You've done very well picking.
And I've used other people's homework too.
Well, yes, you have. Yeah. Cooperate and graduate, as we like to say. So, I liked the home front picture in England in the middle of World War I, where people are carrying on with life as normal as best they can. There's this horrendous war going on. The young men are all gone. Except for one character, one of your special characters.
Oh, Archie.
For not having been drafted into the army.
He's a very funny character. I really love Archie. He's one of my favorites.
Yes.
Oh, yes, he was blind. He was blinded in one eye, so he couldn't go to war. But he gets up to all sorts of mischief with his cousin Ivy, who's a beautiful violinist and a very talented violinist. And she catches the eye of our Professor Mikkel Jacobsen. He's been seconded to the University of Sheffield from Copenhagen. He's both archaeology and Russian, and he speaks six languages. But he loves music, even though he's not musical himself. And, of course, the love story is there between Mikkel and Ivy.
Teshuvah now sings Yahweh. You can hear this and other songs by Teshuvah at teshuvahmusic.com.
Lord of all lords, you are my Shalom, everybody. Welcome to the Midrash portion of Reunion Roadmap. This is David Jones. With me today is Barry Phillips. Shalom, brother.
Shalom, David.
So let me ask you a question, Barry. Mm-hmm. How do you feel when you hear your name? And I know what you're thinking. In what context?
Right? Yes, it depends on who's saying it and how they're saying it.
You know, it's a general thing. People, for the most part, you know, enjoy. If you're in a group of people and then, you know, someone says your name, you look, it gets your attention. And, you know, if you're talking to people and if you say someone's name to someone back to them, it kind of, you know, lets them know that, hey, you remembered my name, and, you know, kind of makes you feel good about stuff. And, you know, when you were a kid and your mom came in the room and said your full name, it just made you feel really special.
Oh yeah.
I'm in trouble now, right? So that's kind of the idea, the thing I'm thinking of. You know, how do you feel? What do you think? What do you do when someone calls your name? But in specifically, what do you do when God calls your name? And I'm thinking of a specific incident, and let me run it out here to you.
Okay.
Exodus 33. Or actually, Exodus 35. Let me get back up here. Exodus 35. We're talking about in the portion of scripture where the tabernacle is being instructed on how to build it. And so in Exodus 35, verses 30-35, says, Moshe said to Bnei Israel, see, Adonai has called by name Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And he has filled him with the Ruach of God, with wisdom, understanding, and knowledge in all manner of craftsmanship, to make ingenious designs, to work in gold, silver, and bronze, as well as cutting gemstones for setting, wood carving, to make all kinds of skillful craftsmanship. And he has also placed in his heart the ability to teach, both he and Oholiab, son of Ahishamach of the tribe of Dan, and he has filled them with wisdom of heart to forge all the works of an engraver, an artisan, an embroider in blue, purple, scarlet, and fine linen, as well as weaving, and they can perform every craft and ingenious design. So literally what we have in this portion of scripture, Yahweh is called by name. The word call, kara, is to call or proclaim something. So he is literally proclaimed out by name, Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, the tribe of Judah. And after he calls him out, he fills him with the Ruach Elohim. And in the process of filling with the Ruachim, the testimony is with wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, which if you do a search throughout the scripture where you, every time you see someone filled with the Ruach Elohim, you see the testimony of wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Mm-hmm. That's another interesting take to go off on. But the point of all this, so he calls him out, and the first thinking is, okay, so why? I mean, he in front of all the sons of Israel, he proclaimed and called out Bezalel. Well, for one thing, to let everybody know the task that he was being imparted with, he is the one who is going to, let's just say, be the foreman for the sake of time and defining things. He's going to be the foreman for this project that we're about to do. And he is the foreman because Yahweh has filled him with the Ruach Elohim and with all these things to equip him to do this job.
Okay.
But he's standing in front of all the sons of Israel, and he's being called out. Now all eyes are on him. Now what does he have to do now? And I'm thinking in this instance, and some of the Midrashes think that he was like 13 years old. That's a whole nother issue. And can you imagine, you know, you're 40 and they're like, we're going to build this thing and you're going to do this. And by the way, this 13-year-old is going to be your foreman. How would most of us react?
Yeah. So, yeah.
But this is the testimony. He called him out. So that got me thinking. There's many different thoughts swirling in my head right now. You know, one, he called him out, then he equipped him, and it was done publicly and everything else. So that's a testimony that's being done there. But what other people, what other situations, what other things do we see happening when Yahweh called people out by name, when Yahweh says, I know your name, what do we see going on here? What happens? And how do we respond to that? And what kind of situations are looking at? And that's kind of very open-ended because there's so many different situations and different people you can kind of talk about from this point. But the underlying question is, so what do you do when God calls your name?
Well, first thing is you have to unshock yourself. It's like the creator of the universe is actually speaking to me.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing I would think is being sure that you're listening correctly. I'm thinking about Samuel, Shemuel, and Yah announces his name to him twice, Shemuel, Shemuel. He doesn't know who it is that is speaking to him.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, he learns and understands, speak, Yah, for your servant is listening. Now, what he hears is not what he wants to hear, because it involves everything that is security around him. The entire system that he is dependent upon is about to fall apart.
Right.
You know, and why would Yah speak to a teenager or a young boy instead of to Eli the priest? Because the only one that is willing to hear is this young kid.
You're right.
You know, I think of David. Yah said, I called you from the sheepfold. Yirmiyahu, I knew you before you were even conceived in your mother's womb. And I'd already ordained that you would be a prophet. Yah knows us in a scary, familiar way. You know, we have heard people probably quote quite often, he knows the number of hairs on your head. He knows you more than that. He knows you in your intentions. He knows you in your feelings. He knows you in your responses to future events. He knows everything there is to know about us, and he uses that, in my understanding, to, it's not manipulating and controlling us into things, but like Pharaoh, he knew the choices that Pharaoh would make before the situation ever presented itself. And he used that foreknowledge to work the entire process of the plagues for Israel's favor and the ultimate deliverance. Does that reduce us to being mere pawns in his plan? No, I don't. I think it's more than that. I think that Yah is looking for servants, and he will call servants by name because he knows us and has chosen us. He can also use those that are his adversaries. But I don't know that he is calling his adversaries by name. They're mere pawns in a plan. But for the chosen ones, we're much more intricately placed and much more strategic to him. So do I want to be just like a piece moved on a chessboard, or do I want to be the significant piece? I don't want to be a pawn. I want to be a rook or a bishop or, you know, the king or queen. You want to be a significant piece to where when we move, things really, really happen.
Yeah. I was reading recently, and I was trying to remember where I read it to properly quote it, but I can't remember. But the thought was, prisoners are acknowledged by their numbers.
Yeah.
People with relationship are acknowledged by their names. So the thought was, you know, numbers is just very impersonal and, you know, like I said, prisoners, but a name is revealing, like when Yahweh calls his child, a name is a relationship, and it's what the Father has called us. And it's interesting how we see in these instances when he calls his people, it's never like when he's calling Shmuel, you know, Shmuel, and he says, yes, Lord, I'm here, you know, Hineni, here I am. And then Yahweh says, nothing. I just wanted to see if you're listening. I mean, no, he had a purpose. He said, I have something that I want you to do. And because of that, here's what's going to happen, but I'm going to equip you to go do these things. And I'm thinking, Isaiah as well, when he had that throne room moment, he's before the Lord. He says, I am undone, right? But Yahweh says, okay, well, I've cleansed you. And then he says, who will I send? Isaiah says, send me. He had this personal moment with Yahweh. And so it was like right there with him, right in front of him. And I'm thinking even Moses, where in Exodus 33, 11 to 17, Moses says, he's talking to Yahweh. He says, and he says, you said that you know me by name and that I have found grace in your sight. And then a little further, Yahweh says, you have found grace in my sight, and I do know you by name. And just kind of reiterating that relationship that the Father has called us to. And so he knows us by name, so what do we do about it? And I guess this kind of leads back into a reciprocal relationship, not to get talking about conflict or conspiracies or anything like that, but he knows us by name. Do we know him by name? And I'm not talking about how you pronounce it. Just to kind of clarify, I'm talking about his character. You know, do we have that relationship with him where, like, I know him? You know, like, I am my beloved is mine. You know, he knows me, I know him. And that's the kind of thing I'm looking at. And because of that, he equips us for what he calls us for. A lot of different things in there. He called Bezalel and Aholiab, and then he equipped them for the task at hand. He didn't say, I chose them for this because they're good at it. He said, I chose them this because I equipped them. What's that mean for us?
That is a key component to any of our walk before him, is that it's rare he calls us because we possess a certain skill or a certain tendency. He calls those who are willing to be qualified. So
I heard not ability, but availability.
Exactly. I mean, when he called me to proclaim his word, the context that I heard that in was, I've called you to preach my word. So for me, my understanding was, I need to stand up like the Pentecostal preachers that I knew. That was the only context that I had. And be able to proclaim the word in this rhythmic, fast-paced, emphatic, emotional, what we call, quote-unquote, anointed preaching. I didn't know how to do that, but I sought him until that ability flowed through me, and it was once I realized how he wanted to do things, it was almost as if it were pushing a button or turning on a switch, almost. I mean, you still had to pray and seek him for it. But the ability to communicate is what's key. And I had to learn. He can use me this way. He can use me that way. That is, sometimes you just stand and you teach. Sometimes you communicate around a kitchen table and you speak softly. Other times it is, you need to stand like a prophet and proclaim the word. We have to be willing to be taught, to be qualified, to be groomed and shaped, and understand he can use you this way, and then he'll use you that way.
Yeah. You know, as you're talking, Barry, it makes me think, you know, like David said, because you brought up David earlier, it makes me think, you know, David, blessed be the Lord my God, that he teaches my hands to war.
And my fingers to fight.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. He taught us his ways and taught us his heart. And that had to be an intimate knowledge, especially for these ones that he called, because they, the ones building the tabernacle, they had to do it exactly to specific, you know, instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to know where they were going. So that's what the Father's called us to, I think, to know his heart and to be able to walk in it.
Well, one thing we also need to learn is we're out of time.
Here we are again.
Here we are again. Folks, thank you for listening. Thank you for any questions and comments that you may want to send to reunionroadmap@BnaiYosephNA.com. We'd love to hear from you. And until next time, shalom, David.
Here is Solomon Lopez with You Are Mine from his album Out of That Place, available at Hebraism.org.
Fear not, for I've redeemed you.
I hope you enjoyed the music. We started with Teshuvah and their worship song, Yahweh. And then Solomon Lopez, his song, You Are Mine. Both of them fit with the Midrash Barry and David recorded for us called When Yahweh Calls Your Name. And I would say it also fits with the first part of our conversation with Suzanne Ratcliffe, because we're talking about the creator and the sovereign of the entire universe. And when he says something, he's going to come through and do it. Stefania, can you give an example of when God came through on the improbable in your life?
I can think of all kinds of situations, but I'll think of what brought me into Torah. I was actually driving on a freeway in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I had it on the radio. And they were mentioning something about this thing called Shavuot, and it was going to be at the St. Paul Civic Center, and this event was going to be the largest gathering of Jews and non-Jews since the Book of Acts. And when I heard that, I got all excited, and I thought, but I'm on the freeway. I can't stop. I can't take the information. What am I going to do? But I want to be here. I want to be at this event. And so I got home 150 miles away, and I had tuned in a few days later. I think it was maybe even I turned on the Christian AM Christian radio station, and they were interviewing a Messianic rabbi who was part of organizing this event. And he gave all the details, and I took them down. And I was convinced that I was supposed to be there. And I thought, oh, even if it's short notice, I'm going to this. And if it means resigning from my job and quitting, I need to go. That's all how much I knew I needed to be there. It didn't have to come to that, because the boss was more than happy to provide the time off for me to get there. And it was a life-changing experience, needless to say, because here I am now.
It sounds like that was a time when Yahweh called your name.
Oh, he absolutely did.
Testimonies mean things because God does work in our lives, and he does call people by name from the womb. That's what Jeremiah says, and I believe that is correct. So where we are now, not just doing our best to observe Torah, keep the Sabbath, keep the feasts, and so on, but understanding our identity as part of the Commonwealth of Israel, and as part of those returning lost tribes of the house of Joseph or house of Ephraim, this is a thing that we haven't made the connection yet. And that's why I am so excited about Suzanne Ratcliffe's novels, because this is a subject that really most people have never heard of. What happens, Stefania, when our kin in the traditional church begin to understand that they could very well be descended from some of the lost tribes of Israel?
Well, identity is everything, because what happens when you discover who you are, you want to act and respond according to your identity. And you'll see an about face happening, and certain things that they used to do, they won't do anymore because they're now embracing who they are, and there's this excitement. And, you know, we were there at one time very excited, and then the Father kind of levels things off a little bit for us and gives us some more equilibrium, so to speak. We won't get it too excited and scare people away.
Well, that's going to have to do it for this edition of Reunion Roadmap. And come back next week. We'll have the second part of my interview with Suzanne. And in the meantime, keep looking for the novel, Stones of Wrath, The Tapestry. And also, go to our website, BnaiYosefNA.com, BnaiYosefNA.com. You can find every single one of our Reunion Roadmap podcasts there, along with a number of resources, as well as a donate button if you feel inclined to partner with us, and we would be greatly honored. So on behalf of Stefania Pappas, Barry Phillips, and David Jones, this is Al McCarn. Shavua Tov.
Thank you for joining us on Reunion Roadmap, a production of B'nai Yosef North America. Please come back next week for another visit with the people of the emerging House of Joseph here in North America.